The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up this week, there's something of the ex-knight about him. Fred Goodwin is stripped of his title as Royal Bank of Scotland executives give back their bonuses. Should political pressure be applied to these state-owned banks, or is it the first step down a very slippery slope? Also this week, whatever you do, don't call it an EU treaty. David Cameron backs down in Brussels as Europe proceeds with its plan to save the euro. And as Nicolas Sarkozy gears up for his attempt at re-election in France, we ask, has the pint-sized president finally got too big for his boots? And could the French left be on the verge of a really big win? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Martin Kettle, The New Statesman's chief political commentator Raphael Baer, and down the line from across the channel, our Paris correspondent Angelique Chrysaphis. A warm welcome to you all. Now, fingers on buzzers. What do Robert Mugabe, Nicolae Ceaușescu and Fred Goodwin have in common? The answer, of course, is that they've all been knighted by the Queen and then had that honour snatched back in disgrace. This week, the former RBS chief became plain Mr. Fred Goodwin. Having lit the fuse on the banking crisis and then made off with a vast pension pot, he became a love-to-hate figure. What Twitter wits branded the circumcision came in the same week that Fred's successor, Stephen Hester, was pressured into handing back his bonus. Martin, is the banker baiting now getting completely out of hand?
Well, I think it's a bit of a proxy for a much wider question, and it's an easier question. It's an easier issue to get your teeth into, as we've seen this week with the Fred Goodwin knighthood stripping. I mean, it's a proxy for the distress caused by the financial crisis and the inability to get past it and to reform the relationship between banking and politics and banking and the economy more generally. And so, you know, it's an easy target. It's a personal target. It's simpler, and that's why politicians get suckered into going for it.
I mean, Angelique, we've had some fairly florid denunciation of financiers in Paris as late, from what we read. Has it become personal in this way? A politician singling out individual bankers for a ticking off?
No, it hasn't yet become personal. And Paris was hugely impressed, of course, by this knighthood story, because they felt, wow, you know, England's ahead of us on this. It's really part of the mood music in France. Don't forget, we've seen Hollande, François Hollande, the socialist frontrunner, saying, you know, my main adversary is the world of finance. But Sarkozy has also made the same type of mood music against the world of banking, and he's the one that's unilaterally bringing in a transaction tax. In the meantime, France has a hugely powerful banking lobby, so it's a slightly hypocritical period we're in France at the moment, where we bash the banks, but the banks are hugely powerful, and they haven't quite got a grasp on how to knock them down a peg.
It could be, Raphael, that there's a bit of hypocrisy on this side of the channel as well, though, couldn't it? I mean, taking away Fred's knighthood at the same time as you're stopping some but not all of the bonuses in that RBS bank, which is of course 83% owned by all of the rest of us, looks like a diversionary tactic, isn't it?
Well, I mean, put it this way, I was watching the debate in the House of Commons about the European summit, in which the Prime Minister seemed to be getting a little bit duffed up over his surrender or otherwise of the veto. And pretty much when he sat down, into my email inbox pings an announcement from the Cabinet Office saying that, goodness me, actually, Fred Goodwin's having his knighthood taken away from him. Now, that might just be an extraordinary coincidence, but quite clearly, there is a political advantage in a very simple story that appeals at a very visceral level on this issue, sort of being around as a sort of smoke grenade so that other issues get discussed a little bit less. I mean, there are two very different points here. One is that the UK government is a majority shareholder of a big bank, and then there's a very sophisticated, as it were, question of how it should manage that shareholding, whether it should make RBS a commercial enterprise or whether it should have a more political sort of public service role because of that shareholding. And there's a completely separate issue, which is, should a man who was given a knighthood for services to banking, turned out not to be such a great banker after all, but who hasn't committed a criminal offence, as far as we know, have that knighthood taken away from him and therefore be categorised alongside Robert Mugabe? That makes me a bit uncomfortable, to be honest.
One person, Martin, who was out on the radio saying quite how uncomfortable it made him this week was Alistair Darling. And many Labour people, I'd have thought, listening to his rather judge-like points about how it would be better that this was all done by the rules, would be staggered to see him ride out of semi-retirement to look at least like he's saying Fred should hold on to his knighthood.
Well, I guess he's defending his record as well. I mean, that's pretty clear. And I mean, Darling, as you say, is semi-retirement, but he's a bit of a player still, and he's quite an important figure, I think, in the Labour Party as it's going forward at the moment. I think I agree with Raphael about this, that, you know, that concentrating on taking the knighthood away from someone who was given it, who hasn't committed a criminal offence, I think that is something to be concerned about. I mean, I think the honours system, you know, it's easy to knock the honours system, but the honours system actually does reward and honour a lot of decent public servants and a lot of good people and people who, you know, who have given a lifetime for this or that cause and, you know, who appreciate the honours. So what's important is not to have the honours system kind of, you know, the caprice of politicians. And it's pretty clear, I think, that Cameron was pushing this reference to this obscure forfeiture committee, which we only heard of its existence this week. He has been flagging up the fact that something needs to be done and could be done about the Fred Goodwin knighthood for some days before that announcement was made. So I think it's, although I'm not by nature one of the great conspiracy theorists, I think it's pretty clear that his fingerprints are all over this.
And you have to remember also that as the economy doesn't perform the way that the government would like it to, it becomes more and more important for Downing Street to push ownership of the banking crisis onto the last government, onto Labour, which is fair enough. They were in charge when it happened. And so they gave Fred the knighthood. And so at every stage, David Cameron would like to be able to say, well, Ed Miliband, here you are saying we'd like to change capitalism and we don't really like greedy bankers trousering bonuses. Let's make sure the Labour brand is all over the banking crisis and all over the worst excesses of that period, which is a completely rational political thing for Cameron to do.
But, I mean, surely... I mean, you're both sounding very judge-like here and going out
That's
of your way to be...
That's the first time I've ever been accused of that, but I'm still
But going out
that.
Of your way to be fair, but surely, like most people, would just think this guy was given a knighthood for services to banking by extension, you know, for making Britain a richer country by building a world-beating company. It turned out to be an absolute hall of... But mirrors and illusion, and he's having his knighthood snatched back. Good thing too, and then why not move on to the rest of them as well?
Well, that's the essence of populism, and sometimes maybe you do need populist gestures because people are angry. And you know, I think the problem really was that actually in that crucial period, sort of 2008 to 2010, there wasn't enough contrition, and when the bankers were in front of the Select Committee in Commons, and they sort of had this apology teased out of them, you know, like blood from a stone. And there was a feeling then that this, you know, that expression of contrition, that, you know, there's just a great big, yes, we are guilty and we're really sorry moment never came. And so that had to get some political expression. But nonetheless, you know, by the measures of the time when he was given the knighthood, he did appear to be a very successful banker. RBS was huge. And I'm sure that you could go over the annals of awards and knighthoods and find plenty of people who history would now judge as having been not so great at what they were perceived to have been great at.
I mean,
he's not Ceausescu, he isn't.
No.
One of the interesting examples there is Alan Greenspan, of course, who was given an honorary knighthood only just a few years ago by Gordon Brown. And in fact, Tony Blair, I think, so mustn't pin everything on Gordon Brown in this, but by Labour. And, you know, Alan Greenspan clearly had his hands over his hands on a lot of the miscalculations which have led to the present financial problems. I mean, I think you shouldn't give knighthoods at all to non-citizens of the UK, but I can quite see politically why it's quite handy for governments to dish out the odd honorary knighthood to presidents and film stars and so on, because it's a cheap gesture, and one mustn't be too puritanical about these things.
But, or about the gesture of snatching it back, then.
Well, I mean, we're all a mixture of roundhead and cavalier, and the balance is always changing.
Well, as Raf's already alluded to, this week David Cameron returned from Brussels amid rather less fanfare than last time around. No longer did he boast of a veto. There was no sign of the previous triumphalism. This time he was forced to back down and allow the signatories of the new Euro deal, not treaty, to use EU buildings and stationery. So, Raf, what do we end up with here? European Union notepaper, European Commission and the European Court of Justice ruling on the dealings of all these clubs of EU members that are not the EU. It's a recipe for a complete pick and mix outfit, isn't it?
At a certain technical level, David Cameron is right. The treaty that was signed by all members of the European Union apart from the UK and the Czech Republic is not a European Union treaty yet, although there is an aspiration to incorporate it into European Union treaty in 5 years or so. Who knows what will happen? But there is precedent for this. There is the Schengen arrangement. There are all sorts of bits of European Union dealings that can be sort of subsets of the wider European Union. So this question of whether EU institutions or buildings or even the Commission or the Court of Justice should be allowed to adjudicate over this is a red herring. It's nonsense. And absolutely confident that David Cameron was very clearly advised, both by senior Conservatives and by all his officials, to just drop this objection. It was completely irrelevant. The real question...
I mean, he was pushing it at one point.
He was pushing it at one point, but largely for domestic consumption. But I'm pretty sure the lawyers came to him and said, you know what, just give up on this. It's never going to happen and you're going to make a fool of yourself. What is much more important for Britain is whether or not this sort of 25 out of 27 group in the future will be able to organise deals around other aspects of European Union business that we really do care about, chiefly what happens in the single market. This is the thing they call caucusing. So you'll have a European summit, which will be a proper European Union affair with everyone, where Britain will have a position. But actually, 25 out of 27 will have stitched up the deal before, in advance, without Britain in the room. Now, in theory, Cameron says he's got safeguards against that happening. I've read the treaty. The safeguards are pretty weak. And ultimately, most people who have sort of been following this seem to be saying there's no reason that they won't be caucusing. It could happen. And David Cameron has to still fight very hard to really get back in there, have that influence. And unfortunately, politically, he's already presented that to the British people as a victory. He says, I've secured this. Actually, he hasn't. And that's a problem for him.
I mean, Martin, it does sound any reassurance you might get about what other people might do in a room when you're not in it. How much can that be worth?
Well, I mean, it's a very tricky thing because basically this so-called veto, I mean, I think it is a so-called veto, was imposed at a very early stage in a process which is still continuing. And so it's just very difficult to present that as time goes on as having prevented something from happening, because what Britain did in December was chose not to be part of a process which almost every other country in Europe is an active participant in. Now, it may be that looks even better in Britain as that if the treaty is a failure in its own terms, and I think people should take the trouble to read the treaty, because it is worth reading, because for economic reasons within the Eurozone, there's a lot to be very wary and sceptical about, because it locks in a whole set of things about the balancing of budgets, which, you know, are part of the problem that Europe and the world is facing, and not necessarily the solution. So it's quite a complicated political game that Cameron has got himself embarked on. His problem domestically is that he appeared to be saying, right, that's it. And a lot of Tory MPs and a lot of the Tory supporting press took him at that headline word. And now, of course, the process is going on, and it will be more and more difficult to present it as an effective prevention of a process which probably a majority of public opinion in this country does think is against the UK's interest.
Yeah, Martin's absolutely right. I think Cameron, he's actually got himself into a bit of a sort of lose-lose situation in that respect, because the Tory Eurosceptics liked the veto as it was presented. They don't now like the fact that this thing is going ahead anyway. But separately, as Martin said, there is this sense that what these other countries are signing up to is something that no sane country should be permitted or encouraged to do. not just because they're choreographing austerity in a downturn, which macroeconomically might be a bit nuts, but because actually, quite clearly, it is a surrender of sovereignty to European authorities over control of your national budget. Now, so for the sort of more ideological Eurosceptics, not only do they obviously not think Britain should be part of that, but they don't think Britain should be encouraging other countries to be part of that. So this sort of pure essence of national Euroscepticism, they think it's sort of just treason all round.
So once again, we're finding Tory leaders can't win on Europe. Angelique, how controversial is all of this in France? First of all, has France noticed Cameron's posturing at all?
Well, they are paying attention to it. I mean, at the beginning, in December, there was quite a lot of relief in France. It was like, okay, this is what the Brits think. They've never been that interested in probably properly taking part in the European Union. They're only interested in the single market. Now, at least, we know where we stand, and we're going to more or less ignore them. And then things in France really shifted onto the French-German axis. But now I think people are starting to look back at Cameron because, of course, if François Hollande, who is tipped at the moment to win the election, gets in...
as the new president...
As a new president, and that would be in May if he was to win. He wants to renegotiate the treaty anyway. He wants to put in new clauses on growth and protecting the welfare state. And, you know, he's already raising questions about whether France would ratify that treaty anyway. So it's a very nebulous area in France at the moment.
And we read that Merkel kind of very actively supporting Sarkozy's re-election bid for this spring.
Yes, I mean, this is all part of, I mean, don't forget the French presidential election is a kind of neo-Napoleonic race between huge personas who tend to be men, was a woman last time around, but basically one man and the nation. And it's very, very, very personal. And the reason that Merkel is so important to Sarkozy here is that he's really floundering and he's really trying to stake everything on his international statesman-like image and the idea that he can somehow get Europe out of this crisis. And so Merkel coming in to help him is kind of par for the course in France, because you always tend to have German chancellors giving some kind of support to people they're working with in Europe. But it's more an idea of Sarkozy sending this message, oh, look at me, I can get Merkel in to help me because I'm so important on the international stage.
But it'd be staggering here, wouldn't it, Raph? I mean, if imagine if George W. Bush had tried to help Blair out in 2005. I mean, Merkel may not be the same controversial figure, but normally they...
Yeah, I mean, I'm to be honest, I'm quite surprised to hear that this is in any way normal. When I heard it, I thought it was quite extraordinary. And I think it expresses something very peculiar that's happening in European politics at the moment. I, looking again at this treaty, I find it very hard to understand how you could, as it were, lock half of Europe into a set of budgetary policies that their electorates and their publics might not like, quite clearly at the behest of the sort of the German finance ministry, and that not be a problem culturally and politically in those countries. So I confess to be slightly baffled.
Well, of course, it could backfire on Sarkozy in the sense that in France, you know, France is in this horrific state in terms of the economy, and you know they do need, you know, Sarkozy is really saying, you know, we've got to be more like Germany, we've got to do everything we can to become German, and people don't like being told what to do by another country. I mean, that's for
particularly
sure
Germany.
The same here among voters.
Yeah,
well,
I mean, yeah. I think in the context of the evolution of the EU, this is a really important moment, interesting moment anyway, because it suggests, I mean, what we have now is in the last few months in Europe, I think, is the clear recognition that Germany is first and France is second. And for most of the previous 40 years, the conceit sometimes, but the orthodoxy has been that France and Germany together decide what happens in Europe. And I think what's happened in the financial crisis of the Eurozone, you know, has changed that. And that's why I find the Sarkozy invitation to Merkel surprising, because it seems to me that Sarkozy has actually presided over the relegation of France from an absolutely dominant position in the European political network to the secondary one, and that wouldn't be something I would be terribly keen to advertise if I was running for re-election.
And interestingly, I mean, my understanding of one of the reasons that Cameron ended up wielding this veto or non-veto in December is a miscalculation that he was very confident that Germany would be desperate to keep, and that Merkel would be desperate to keep Britain on board for, you know, because traditionally Britain has sort of balanced out France's influence in the European Union. It turned out that in the end, Germany thought, no, saving the Eurozone is more important than Cameron. If you can't be part of this, you can just sit on the sidelines.
So, Angelique, you've already mentioned there the French presidential election coming up, two rounds, the first one at the end of April, isn't it? And the second one in May, the sort of tie break. How does this play into that race and how's it looking?
Well, that's what I was going to say about Merkel coming over. I mean, let's not underestimate how desperate Sarkozy is. And this is all, you know, inviting Merkel over is all part of that desperation. We're 80 days away from the election. It's a two-round election. Sarkozy is polling very low. If the election happened tomorrow, the polls saying that François Hollande would win outright, he's being trailed by Sarkozy in the polls. There's about a 7-point gap. And then we have the extreme right, Front National, Marine Le Pen, coming up behind him, and another centrist, François Bayrou. So there's four people in the running here, and it'll go down to a second round runoff. The French president has never been this low just before a re-election battle. Sarkozy has fallen from grace in a staggering way, and his party have been saying, no, he will be able to claw his way back up. He's not going to announce his actual candidacy until March because he's trying to wait until the last minute. And what he's banking on at the moment is a kind of Gerhard Schroeder approach, which is, I'm going to have a blitz of last-minute radical reform because I don't care how unpopular I am. My idea is to show you guys that, you know, public interest comes first.
Right. It's
quite a risky strategy.
And so is he so far behind them? I mean, previously in France, we saw the socialist candidate, Lionel Jospin, being knocked out by Jean-Marie Le Pen before it got to that second round, didn't we, a decade ago or so. Is Sarkozy potentially going so low that he could be knocked out before it gets to the knockout, if you see what I mean?
Yeah, he could be knocked out of the knockout. It's a real possibility. I mean, it's something that all people are dreading, really. François Hollande, who's a socialist frontrunner, is dreading Le Pen knocking out Sarkozy, because what happens there is you get the extreme right coming through to the second round, and you've got a country that's hugely pessimistic at the moment anyway, and hugely divided along race lines, along class lines, and this idea that Le Pen coming in with her ideas would...
Sorry,
really...
we should just explain. It's Marine Le Pen now, who's the daughter of Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is the chap waving the flag for the extreme right last time round.
Exactly. If she gets through into the second round, she is being touted as a more palatable person than her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen. She's running a campaign not just on things like immigration, but she's also trying to go down the French line of bashing the bankers, anti-globalisation. She's actually winning votes from the left, but she's likely to cause the most damage to Sarkozy. And if that happens, obviously whoever runs against Marine Le Pen will win. I mean, no, Marine Le Pen will never be elected president, but the problem is that will make whoever does win very, very fragile indeed. So all parties want to bash her down, but she's doing very well. She's polling around 19%.
And roughly where Sarkozy is? He just a few points ahead of her?
Yes, Hollande's on around roughly 30, and Sarkozy's sort of 24, 23 in some polls. So we've got Hollande. I mean, the real race now is to make Hollande exciting. You know, he's this kind of technocrat who ran the Socialist Party for 11 years. One of his nicknames is Flamby, which is a kind of a wobbly blancmange creme caramel dessert here. And his main challenge was to make himself really this kind of exciting persona. He's going down this plodding route of, you can trust me, I am left-wing, but I am going to bash the debt. I'm not high-taxing, high-spending. You know, I can get you out of the crisis.
Martin, you wrote in a column this morning that much of Europe's not in a mood to kind of dream of a different economic model just now, or at least it doesn't know what that is. And yet, blancmange-like as Hollande may be, it sounds like he's coming up with some relatively kind of radical ideas, or at least rhetoric.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And you know, as Angelique says, I mean, he is doing well. He is now the man to beat. Of course, the French electoral system does slightly accentuate that. I mean, as Angelique says, you know, he's actually on around 30% in the polls, not on about 60%. So he's polling roughly the same as most social democrats in most countries
Ms.
in Western
Gordon
Europe. Having said all that, the election of Hollande would be a remarkable event, because it would be consistent in one sense, which is that incumbents find it very difficult to get re-elected in hard times, and we've seen loads of examples of that. And you know, the defeat of Sarkozy would be another example of it. On the other hand, it's quite rare across the Western world for left parties to be the clear beneficiaries of that, at least at the moment. one can take refuge in trying to say, well, you know, France is always different. And to some extent, I think that is true. But nevertheless, it would be a very major event because it would have a huge impact, as we were saying before, in the Eurozone. And it would be, I think, the market reaction to Hollande winning, or to the prospect even of Hollande winning, is going to be a major, major factor over the next, not just 80 days, but the next few months.
Raph, do you think we're used to the idea that there's an election over the water in America and that has big kind of ripples over here? Do you think France could have the same power in terms of English political dynamics?
I think, well, traditionally...
British, you mean, I think, yes. Tom.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I've gone SNP this week.
Traditionally, we get more excited about the US elections, and there's been an extraordinary amount of coverage, I think, of the Republican primary race, partly, obviously, because they have the common courtesy to conduct it in a language that we all
English.
Know. Whereas I think the election of the sort of the first socialist president in France for, what, 16 years... at a time when European Union diplomacy, as we've been discussing, is incredibly fluid, at a time when the whole conversation about, you know, what the state can do when there's no money and how the sort of globalization liberal capitalist order can absorb the shocks that it's been hit with in the last few years, particularly in the European context, is the biggest conversation around. Quite obviously, this French presidential election is more important to the UK than the American one in November, but we're just not culturally used to looking at it in that way.
But do you think it would, for example, you know, that when Obama became a phenomenon, and lots of the rhetoric around hope and change and a new transparent political order.
If you're asking me, could a sort of slightly blancmange, maybe not terribly exciting, but orthodox social democratic leader being elected in a neighbouring European country affect British politics in the way it's discussed? Yes, I can see how that might be the case.
Except that, Tom. I mean, yeah. When it happened in 1981, and Mitterrand was elected at the time when the Thatcher government was beginning to get into gear,
yep.
It had absolutely no impact whatsoever.
No.
And the fact that there was a really quite radical socialist program at first taking place just 19 miles across the sea elicited absolutely no interest whatsoever from the British political class, including the Labour Party, you know, who are indifferent to what happened, the entire Mitterrand period, but utterly transfixed as ever with the Labour Party on what was going on in America at the same time, much more interested in Walter Mondale than François Mitterrand.
Oh dear. Well, look, Angelique, we are interested here, I promise you. Is your reading of it that Hollande is not just kind of pushing things in a left-wing direction on the economy, but also maybe reasserting the kind of nationalist, Gaullist tradition of, you know, when he's talking about renegotiating treaties and so on?
I think, what he's trying to do is defend France's social models, this idea of this all-encompassing welfare state, which he sees as he will be the defender of in Europe. So he doesn't want sweeping austerity measures, you know, which really is seen, you know, those cuts that are happening in Britain, France is looking on with horror. He wants to try and find a way to steer a path in Europe to say, look, we still can protect people. We don't have to be sort of savagely there slashing everything that helps social protection in the world. So no on that front. But at the same time, you know, this is the first time we've had such a limited socialist manifesto in France in a presidential election because of the crisis, because they've got such limited room for manoeuvre. So he's preparing France for 2 years of belt tightening as much as he can, tax increases for the rich. And then he's planning his great sort of socialist left-wing redistribution of wealth. So he's trying to not make promises, because of course Sarkozy made massive promises and didn't deliver. He's trying to be as muted as possible.
Well, we shall be returning back across the channel as the spring plays out. But in the meantime, my thanks to Angelique Christophers, to Raphael Baer and to Martin Kettle. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.